All right. Good. Glad you came this morning. You know, I think was in Romans talks about the message in clay pots. You know, this treasure in clay pots. Well, those are the clay pots. And a little different story here, but yeah. And you see that again and again and again and again. And I'm just finishing Leonard Stein's book, The Balthazar Declaration, 663 pages. I'm up to the last 100 pages. So this has been one of those treasures I have really enjoyed. It's going to be on my top best list. Now, I know that it's a different category book. You know, it's not a theological book, but such a refreshing book to read, written in 1961. And he was, this Leonard Stein was the secretary inside of that Jewish organization that these guys were part of too. And from about 1920 on, and he died somewhere after 61. I forget what his date, the age of his death was, author. But what's so refreshing about this author, he writes old style in that he doesn't give his opinion about stuff. He just reports stuff. And so much of what you read today, if they, somebody writes you, they want you to know what they think so that you can agree with them what they think. You know, you sort of are pushed in the direction. He just puts it forth as a Jew. And a lot of times he talks about the anti-Semitism that's out there and he reports it as if it was a stone, you know, a concrete block. I mean, he just talks about it. He doesn't get emotionally involved in it. So it's been a refreshing thing. So, yeah, very, very insignificant people are used in many ways. And there are so many moving parts to this. And that's something that in our lifetime we'll never know, even reading a book like that. I just, all it does for me is open up so many more doors of stuff where I now can see where God worked. I had no idea it was working. And so my little story was a bucket of washers. They all going to be lined up. You can stick a stick through the holes, and they all lined up. And that's probably an understatement. It's so much more complicated than that. And God is, you know, in charge of making this all happen. And then I go back to the idea of his word again. He said, let there be light in the beginning. The same person that said, let there be light, also said to Abraham, this is your land. The same power that created the earth is going to see to it that Abram gets the land. In some ways, it seems like it might be over more difficult in Abram getting land because all these independent moving parts out here are against this, and yet God makes it work out so they all get their way, and they end up, it produces the exact will of God as he intended it. And that itself is just remarkable how God can do that without forcing it on people. It's never forced on people. They do everything. Every person does, every sinner does what they want to do. And when they're done doing it, they said, I did it. And yet when it's all done, it works exactly in the direction of the Jewish promises, which is incredible. All right, lest I take all my time in my introduction is long enough, but I'm going to do what you said. I'm not going to rush this. Okay, there's the story. I got 4 weeks, including today. Then Larry's going to teach for 4 weeks with you. Yeah, 3 weeks. I'm going to be gone for whatever it is. Whatever it is. So I want to get this land part done before I leave. That's my objective. But I don't want to rush it either. So when stuff comes up like it has this week that I thought about since last week, I want to talk to you about it because I think in the overall picture of things, you get a overall scheme of things, you get a better picture of it if you see more of the details, and the same details all of a sudden fit into the bigger picture, and all of a sudden you start to understand how this works. So it doesn't necessarily have to be you go from the point A to point Z in one order. So anyway, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Important book by Walter Kaiser. A quote from him, it's Jewish Christianity, Why Believing Jews and Gentiles Parted Ways in the Early Church. And it's exactly, in this last chapter, is exactly on our point, on the Abrahamic covenant. He says it is important to note that even before dispensationalism became popular in Britain around 1830 with Darby, the two different views concerning Israel's relevancy to the church today has almost as long a history as the history of the church itself. In other words, it goes back to the beginning. The issue of the church and the Jews and the church has been an issue from the time the church began. Paul even wrote 3 chapters in Romans addressing this issue. So it did go back to the early church. Thus, the issue of the enduring relevancy of the divine promises made to Israel there have often been vigorously debated in the history of the church ever since the second century. So he basically goes back to the beginning. This issue has not gone away. It's been there from the beginning. And in the 21st century, it is as live and well as it ever has been. So why then, did I miss a section? three, four. That's it. So why then, it's still his quote, why then after all this time should a Christian be concerned with this question about Israel and the church? Why are they interested in this question? Are there not bigger and more important issues to cover than this one, which seems so peripheral? And that's what you get from our covenantal friends or anybody that's not dispensational. Why are you worried about the Jews in the Old Testament? Isn't God done with them yet? It's just a peripheral issue about the land. Why you focus on that? All that does is cause trouble in the Middle East, and they want to kill each other over the land. So let's get on to more important things like our salvation. There's another reason why the question of Israel and the church has come back in the 21st century, and I might say in the 20th century, which demands answers from both Israel and the church. The Jews need to answer this too, as well as the church. Two brand new events in our recent history have given us a whole new urgency to this question. The first was the Shoah. By the way, that is the Holocaust. That's the Hebrew word for the Holocaust. The Shoah, if you want to put that in your vocabulary. The Shoah in Nazi Germany, that's number one. And number two, the announcement of the recognition of the new modern state of Israel on May 14, 1948. And we've been focusing on number two in our study. And as I said, when God said that there be light, or to Abraham, I give you this land, there's no reason to understand God in any other way than Abraham did. In fact, God told Abram to walk on it with his feet, jump on it, play in the mud, whatever, to remove any doubt about his meaning. That's why God had Abram walk on it. You don't walk on clouds, at least I don't think we do. So God had Abram walk on it throughout the width of the length of it. This is the land I'm going to give you. Is it more clearer than that? So this was a way of for Abraham to gain assurance of God's meaning. It's not allegorical. It's not spiritualized. It is what he can walk on. Why is this so hard? So this was literal. And it goes on to say even not within even his literal family, it's to his descendants, not to Eliezer, who was a servant in his household. So when we're done with the promise that God made to Abraham, there is no blurring of God's what God meant. Why have we lost track of it? Not we, but why has the Christian church lost track of it? Now, the idea that God has no interest in the land, they say. Remember my friend said, why are you interested in the land? Don't you want Jesus? The idea that God has no interest in the land, according to the statement, since Christ died to save souls, well, no interest in land may fit, I call Gentile hubris. The Gentiles, what God is doing, this is hard to say, but what God is doing in the world today is saving Gentiles. Oh, by the way, Jews too. But he's saving us. We're so important. I mean, this is how I get it. And I call it Gentile hubris. It's all about salvation. It's always about salvation. For the covenantalists, everything is about salvation. And they ignore everything else. Even if God doesn't ignore everything else, they do. But when God says something, it is not wise to decide what part of his utterance is significant. Is all of it not significant? Perhaps we forget that God's greatest, that in God's greatness, he can multitask. He can save the soul and save the land for the soul. Now again, if you're going to Hellenize stuff, the land you're going to go to is someplace else. It's not really this earth at all. We don't care about this because the real heaven is somewhere else. That's Hellenizing Christianity because that's what the Greeks thought. You know, this land was somewhere else. So the Bible presents these ideas as complementary acts. If you're going to have Abraham with promises, he's going to have some place to live them out. And they're not somewhere off in some Greek island in the sky. This is the place where Abraham is expecting even the city to be formed, it says. While a Hellenization of, I hope you're starting to understand what I'm talking about when I say Hellenization. While a Hellenization of Christianity did not occur until about the 5th century with Augustine, the rejection of the normal reading of the Bible was already in vogue before when Origen died in 254. So let's say he died, lived 100 years. So by 200 already, we're reading the Bible allegorically. Now, what the damage Origen made was not that he rejected the literal meaning of the text. He did not reject the literal meaning of the text. He just put it on the bottom of its importance. Now, what is at the bottom of that which is unimportant? does it not just get forgotten? Exactly what happened. So the more important is the allegorical. The literal is the least important. It's important, but it's not that important. So when Origen added new kinds of interpretation, and there were four altogether in Scripture, the literal meaning of Scriptures fell to unimportance. It was up to Augustine to use his divine view of Greek philosophy. Remember, he said, if it would not have been for Greek philosophy, I would not have come to be a Christian. That's an incredible statement to me. So Greek is very important to Augustine. So when we have, okay, I'll read it again. His use of his divine view of Greek philosophy to fill the vacuum that was created by discounting the literal. So if the literal doesn't drive the Scripture, what does? Something's got to go in there. The allegorical goes in there. You just can't have a vacuum. So once the literal Bible is rejected, which is what happened, Greek ideas fill the void quickly. I mean, it's almost like water runs downhill. It does run downhill. And if you have water, it's going to run downhill. And so we have this. There's a vacuum in our understanding of Scripture. We don't know what it means. Somebody's going to step in and say, well, this is what it means, and it's going to be allegorical because the literal has been rejected. Once you reject the literal, there's nothing left but the false. So this is the legacy, the history of the medieval church to the Reformation churches up into including today. We go down the road to our covenant churches who teach covenantalism. This is how they are, allegorizing the Scripture, especially the Old Testament. So as Kaiser again said, that the announcement of the recognition of the new modern state of Israel, May 14, 1948, is an issue. So we're concerned with that one. Number two, it is our privilege to live a day when the promise of the restored land has been realized before our eyes, or at least closely. I was born in 37, so I was 11 years old, and I don't remember this. I do not remember this, but it happened in my lifetime. Now, on the Shoah, the Holocaust, he makes it a matter of fulfillment. I'm not sure I can do that because there's been so much persecution of Jews over the years. Why do I say this is it was the worst, as far as we know? Half the people were destroyed in the Holocaust, half as we know. But anyway, I understand the spirit of it, so I'm not going to argue that it is a fulfillment of it, but I think the fulfillment of Israel as a state is a fulfillment of it, or, as I say, as close as we can have it without revelation. If God said something in the book of Revelation, a revelation in the book, then we might say, then we could say that. But since God hasn't said that 1948 was that day, it's not in the Bible, I've got to leave a little bit of space for I can say I could be wrong. But every day we go on, the truth of it, the truth of the history, we've seen it gets more and more confirmed. It's just not heading away from Israel being in the land. It's heading more and more security that they will never leave the land. Since we are not reading about the Balfour in the Bible, we can make mistakes. And I'm aware of that. So I read to try to minimize the mistakes. And I made a few last week, but I forgot what they were already. But there's kind of like smaller ones. But still, mistakes are mistakes. And I want to misrepresent anything. So we claim no infallibility or prophetic light or insight. We read, observe as a common reader. And then this week I came upon something that was very interesting in the book. So I'm going to try this on you since we're not in a hurry, Tom. What about the information? In other words, what I want you to do is you see things in history that are happening and you've learned about it. And you wonder, well, what does that mean? Is it this or is it that? All right, so here's an example of this. There were Jews in Britain. Some had come recently from Russia. Remember, the Jews in Russia, Germany, England, France, Belgium, Poland. You know, Russia and Poland, the same thing. You know, virtually the borders move. That's why they're Poland and Russia. All right, so you have Jews everywhere. So this is the time of... the Russian aristocracy is under attack. In other words, the king and the queen, they end up getting executed in 17. So we have a lot of the Russians leave, some Russian Jews leave and have gone to England. And Germany ends up being almost the Jewish center of, the center of gravity for Jewishness. And that's a whole story I'm not even going to get into. But I want you to remember that there's Jews everywhere. Significant numbers of Jews everywhere. Everywhere important, I should say. So there were Jews in Britain. Some had come recently from Russia. Remember the pogroms in 1881 chased some of them out. In this group of residents, there were many of age military men who were not in the Allied armies. They're not in the army. Jews are not in these armies. And the reasons are many. Some were not trusted. Some were pacifists or, you know, you're going to have a Jew fighting in my army. After all, his Jewish brothers over in Russia. And Russia's our enemy. You know, who can we trust a guy like this in our army? That's one of the reasons. All right, so with this army, this group of men of military age are not in the army. Vladimir Jabotinsky came up with an idea. It was the idea of some Zionists to form a Jewish military legion that could be deployed into Palestine to help. And we end up finding that Allenby is one that's going to take over the attacks in the Palestine and succeed in conquering it, British. So the Zionists were thinking that we should help the British conquer Israel or Palestine. After all, they think it's their land. Wouldn't that be a nice thought? So it was the brainchild of Latimer who later formed the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. I just said that here because it did start quite early in 1920-21. Now, the regimental badge was to be a representation of the King David's shield. I gave you a picture of somebody's idea what that would look like. On the surface, this seems like an idea hatched in heaven, doesn't it? After all, the Jews fighting for their own land. Did that not happen under Joshua? So the Jews organized as Israel take the land back from the Gentiles. Doesn't that almost have a biblical ring to it? You don't know what you should agree with me or not, don't you? That's probably smart. You're just going to stay neutral right now. Unless you can look ahead and see what's going to happen here. But surprises of surprises. The whole idea nearly destroyed the Zionist movement on the night of its birth, the ball flower, because Weizmann, up there, the first guy, second guy, a supporter of this army, this regiment, attempted to resign twice over this issue. I mean, we have, it's like the doctor at the point of birth, and he decides, and I could do this. And there's the poor woman giving birth to a child, what's she going to do? It was that kind of situation when Weizmann was going to quit. But it was over this issue. This issue, the surprise, surprise, the whole idea nearly destroyed the Zionist movement. Weizmann, a supporter, attempted to resign twice over the rejection of the Jewish Legion. So the Jewish Legion never was formed, and the Jews fought within the armies of the national residents. So the Jews still fought, but they didn't fight as a separate group. Now, is it not obvious that God did not intend a Jewish legion to be formed to conquer the land? Is that pretty obvious? How do you know that? It didn't happen. That's right. I mean, I can be really bold sometimes. When something didn't happen, I could say God didn't mean it. All right. So it's obvious that God intended no Jewish legion to conquer the land. Now the question is, why would God stop this? It seemed like something that would be so normal. Why should you answer my question? Do you have one in your mind? Don't you keep it there? See if it matches this one. Remember, we're this little experiment here. When you read about history, what do you make of it? What do you make of this fact that there's trying to be some of these Jews going to get together and take their land? But why? Since the legion was to be identified with King David's shield, his army, would not that identification usurp in some way the role of the coming son of David to conquer? Plausible. The army to conquer the land will arrive from heaven and not from earth. Now that may be a small issue, but I think there's something here. You don't want to have to say, well, the Lord came back, but part of what happened on earth, they were already destroying some of the Gentile forces. No. No, when the Lord comes back, it's going to be totally his army, his destruction. There's no credit even given to the Jews. This is going to be something that God's going to do. And the Jews, even though they're his people, they're his chosen people, they have nothing to do with conquering the land. So the army on earth is not under the leadership of the messianic king. There must be no sharing of the glory. They can't use even David's shield, the sign of the nation, the king, even the Israelites. Because it says in Revelation 19, verse 15, it says, you know the story here, and when he comes at the second advent, from his mouth comes a sharp sword so that with it he may strike down the nations. This is where it happens. It doesn't happen when the Israelis take on the land. It doesn't happen that way. Now, that's the question. Is this a plausible scenario, or is this way out on a limb? Don't answer that question. But I think these are tests that you can do. Look, what's happening here? What else can we see behind it? So I don't know why they wouldn't. In my heart of hearts, I do not know why they did not allow. I know the reasons that they gave. But why in the long run, why did God not allow them to take the field against the Turks? Obviously, he didn't want them to do that. The only reason I can see why he didn't want them to do that is because God's going to get the glory for all of its conquering. Now, what the nations do with fighting each other, that's fine. They've been doing that forever, so that's not a problem. But when someone takes up the shield of David and goes to conquer in its name, now you're getting into messianic territory. With that, I rest my case. See, not even into my done, finished my introduction yet. Last week, some fixes. Zionism. Last week, we took a short trip, 40 minutes, 30 minutes, through Zionism's history. I told you what I was going to tell you. I told you what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you that again. That the Balfour Declaration, written by the British for the Jews, stated Britain's intent to establish a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. The letter was sent by Foreign Secretary Lord Balfour in the British government under Lord George to a Jewish leader, Rothschild. It was delivered or sent, dated November 2, 1917, 1 year and days before the armistice. The war was still going on. In fact, it was this time exactly, or almost to the day, that the war in Palestine turned into the British favor. There was an attempt to take the Gaza Strip, which still is a problem, a gift of Egypt to Solomon's wife, who was Egyptian. The Egyptian gave the Gaza Strip to Israel, but it's always been outside of Israel's thing. To our day, we call it the Gaza Strip. Well, that Gaza Strip was hard to overcome, so they had three attempts to in World War I to take the Gaza Strip. In fact, the general that tried to take it finally had to be removed, and he suggests another one. He didn't take it. So finally, in the end, Allenby does it. We know him from taking Jerusalem. So what I'm saying, when this thing is offered out, and this is one of those kind of things, is there any connection here? When the Gaza Strip got defeated and they started moving towards Jerusalem is when this letter was sent in time. All right? Now, there's a connection there. Because they didn't want to send the letter until they knew for sure that they were going to take Palestine in British. Didn't want to send a letter until they knew for sure, but if they're going to offer this land to the Jews and they don't have the land in tow, what kind of offer is that? So once Gaza fell, then it became really apparent the rest of the country is going to go easy, and that's exactly what happened. So last week we took a short trip to Zionism history. I'm going to tell you that the Balfour Declaration was written by the British for the Jews, stated Britain's intent to establish a homeland for the Jewish people at the very time they're starting to take the land. The letter was sent by Foreign Secretary Lord Balfour, and in our government, we would have such an international foreign person. I mean, maybe something like to the UN, you know, Foreign Secretary. You would deal with foreign nations, that person, that was Balfour. And by the way, they had just come into power in England. They had just come into power. Hadn't been there for years. And they don't last long either. And then I'll tell you that later. So a letter was sent by a Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, to a Jewish leader named Rothschild, because no one else was, as you know, you didn't want to send to these guys that were kind of official. You sent to the Jewish people and said, "You take it and you let it, you know, you let this be known to the Jewish people. However you want to do this." Okay, as I said, 1 year before the armistice. But before the letter was sent, the Allied parties, the Entente, another word for the Allies, along with the Catholic Church, had already signed off on the idea of a Jewish, I'm going to say, state. Now, that's not what the Bauflauer said, but that's what they had signed off on. In fact, the nations all expected a Jewish state to emerge from the reorganization of the nations after World War I. They expected that. So the Bauflauer letter was not the beginning of the effort, but this was the interesting part, not the beginning of the effort, it was the end of it, the culmination of many years' worth of strenuous efforts from 1914, perhaps, in European history, by perhaps a dozen men, I didn't count them, a bunch of guys who acted on behalf of Zionism. Some of them were Jews, some were Gentile leaders, and they're from many nations. Talk about getting the washers lined up. Now, a couple of more things. Another big subject, only mentioned here, was how that each of the nations followed their self-interest, which was used, obviously divinely authored, in a triangulation effort. In other words, you have, well, my example is the Catholic Church in Italy, the Catholic Church in France, were in competition with each other. Remember when there was the extra number of popes? There were Avignon, France. There were three of them at one time reigning at the same time. They were in France. So we have France and Italy always at each other in the Catholic sense. Well, at the bottom of this triangle are the Jews. So that's the triangulation. Okay, at the bottom are the Jews. And the Catholic Church is trying to placate or satisfy the Jews. And so they play off each other, and the Jews get the best. All right, that's what I was calling about triangulation. It's a tactic that probably Trump uses to our advantage, for example. So another big subject, and only mentioned here, was that each nation followed their self-interest, which was used in the triangulation to force nations to act in a manner that favored Zionism. So whatever battle these two guys have together, the end result was the Jews benefited from it. So I said my example was the Catholics in Italy and Catholics in France played off each other to the benefit of the Jewish state. And that happens between Russia and Germany, between Germany and Russia, and on and on and on. France and England. And the Jews always seem to be the one that benefited from these conflicts. The washers are lining up. Okay, while a dozen or more negotiators were busy getting support for Zionism, the effort at time was on the verge of blowing up. The internal job was to develop some kind of measure of unity amongst the Jewish people for a homeland. Remember we said that there were many anti-Zionists who were Jews? I would say probably the majority of all the Jews in all the world would have been anti-Zionists. Yes. Remember the phrase, World War II got the land ready for the Jews, and World War II was the war getting the Jews ready for the land. That says the Jews weren't ready for it. So the Jews, you got to understand what the Jews were going to lose. In Russia, for example, the aristocracy got overthrown in spring of 1917 that had been so oppressive. As soon as the king was dethroned, all those restrictions on the Jews in Russia were removed. Now, if you were a Jew and you say, well, we're free like everybody else now is, they don't see down the road another revolution called the Red Revolution. They don't see that coming. But if you're a Jew in Russia, in the Pale, in Poland, that area that Russia controlled, they'd say, oh, don't rock the boat. Just now when we got our freedom, why do you want us now to go to the land? We're fine where we are. So it seemed. So it isn't unusual for these Jews to say, we're better off where we are now. Then again, somebody's going to raise our hope to go back to the land. It never happened before, and you raise it up again. We have a lot of disappointment, children, and we have to tell them it's not going to work out after all, and we've got to go back the way it was before. I'm not even going to risk it. We'll stay where we are. And that was probably most of it. Not that they were against having the land. It was that they couldn't do it. They couldn't see it being possible. That was after they left the land, yeah. Okay, you get the idea. You get the idea. So what did Moses' biggest problem was? Keep the people together. That's what I'm saying here. We have all the problems we have with all the nations, with Israel, not Israel, with Italy, with France, the Catholic Church, Russia is involved in here, Germany is involved in, the Turks own the land, all this stuff there. Those are our big problems. But the biggest problem was to get the Jews together. Because if the Jews aren't together, you can't go with the story, right? You can't go to the king and say, well, we want this. No, half of us want this and half of us want that. And the king says, just go away. Come back when you got a story that everybody agrees to. So I think the lack of unity of the Jewish people here is as critical issue as the lack of or the support we got from the Gentiles. All right, so while a dozen or more negotiators were busy getting support for Zion, the effort at times was on the verge of blowing up. The eternal job was to develop some kind of measure of unity amongst the Jewish people for a homeland. And that's what Weissman was mostly about. By the way, I had his name spelled wrong. It is Weissman. It's E and I had it reversed. I have it reversed there. So it's E-I, and when you have two vowels together, you always pronounce the second vowel. So thank you for pointing that out, but it was the correction that was at a different place. I've been saying Weissman all my life. That's what I'm going to do now. It's because Weissman, that doesn't sound right. But anyway, I looked up, it's spelled wrong. That's why. All right, so we go on. So we said there were many anti-Zionists who were Jews in Russia, England, and America, and Italy, and on and on and on. For all kinds of reasons, these foot-dragging Jews were as much a problem as getting the Gentiles and nations on board. But in the end, Zionism prevailed marginally. One of the votes was 50 to 56. 56 being for Zionism. That's how close the vote was, one of the votes, to produce the Balfour. And lastly, from last week, I failed to give you the punchline. I'm never a good storyteller, you know, because I always forget how the punchline goes, and when you butcher the punchline, the joke's no good. All right, so I didn't give you the punchline last week, and you maybe didn't even notice it, but I will give it to you today. All right, last week, I failed to give you the punchline of the lesson. The nations were in agreement with what was to be written in the Balfour. This is where I stopped. What it didn't tell you is that the letter sent to a Jewish leader is just that. That's all it was. It's a piece of paper that could lay on Rothschild's desk and rot. It didn't have any power. Well, then why are we spending so much time on the letter? That's the punchline. So the punchline is that the very language of the Balfour letter was picked up verbatim in the downstream legal documents where it became binding on the subscribing nations, where the words achieved the force of international law. You understand what I'm saying? The letter itself did nothing. But when you're going to write international law, they sourced this letter, saw what it said, and we're going to spend time next week or whatever talking about how difficult it was to come up with this wording. So, and this was approved by the nations. This was approved by the Jews. Why in the world would a nation that's trying to organize the division of the post-World I world change what they have given you as what was acceptable? So it comes to them acceptable. So they just pick up the language. You have it here. In the letter, there's Majesty's government, second paragraph, view with favor the establishment of Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done that may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in other countries. In another country. That was picked up and pasted into documents that the nation signed. Now we have something that has authority. Until that happens, and by the way, this happened more than once because one organization passed it on to the next, and it finally goes to the League of Nations. But it stays intact. That Balfour statement stays intact. That's why the Balfour is so important. It has no authority on its own. It only has authority as it is picked up by other documents. Does that make sense? Does it make sense? I mean, you're not into international law, are you? Okay, Balfour, say it one more time, I guess. The Balfour letter had no power. I could write, I give you $1 million. Give it to you know, over here. And what's it mean? Absolutely nothing. Unless I write a check. I got to have $1 million, I guess. Don't worry about those. Not a good example. But it doesn't mean anything until somebody else recognizes it. When Israel says I'm a nation, it doesn't mean anything until somebody else recognizes it. We went through that a little bit last week. All right. The Balfour Letter had no power. It was only a political statement of intent. It carried the weight of the British government like our national cabinet-level support. So we have the Trump gets together, those cabinet, they all vote on something. That level is what we got here. We don't have Congress doing this. So without any further action by the nations, even if they had already agreed to its terms that they had, the Balfour had no authority by itself. It needed contractual language with national signatories. Again, we have the Entente nations agreeing to a Jewish homeland in Palestine approximately in the first half of 1917, the time of the Russian Revolution, the White Revolution, and the British struggle with the language for 3-4 months to get to the Balfour, which was finally approved by their war cabinet, October 31, 1917. And by the way, the United States was the last to get on board. So after months of anti-Zionism and pro-Zionist desire to get it right during the Weissman, during this time, Weissman nearly resigns over the David Legion issue. They agree on the language that does not betray the Entente group, the family, the nations, the West, and yet gets to the Jews a space in Palestine, and that space is undefined. In the Balfour, it is undefined. Don't know whether it could be under the Jewish, what's the word, suzerainty? Suzerainty? That's a word that you see around, but it's kind of like their authority. It's under their, like a king has a reign. So we don't know by Balfour what they're actually going to get. The Jews don't know what they're going to get. Some say, it can't be a state. I don't want a state. That's too much. Oh, we're going to be in a lot of trouble to get a state. And others say, no, it's got to be a state. We can't be anything else but a state. So you have this bickering going back and forth. So the language is left on purposely vague, I think. All we're going to have is space in Palestine. And we got the proverbial nose of the camel in the tent. That's all they needed. This is a lot less than establishing a state. But the Jews could not expect more and could not dictate its terms. And then I got this last statement, which is, this is a small statement of a big, big, big issue. Behind this is the unexplained power of the powerless Jews. Remember we talked about the protocols of the elders last week? That was a bogus document, a fakery, that charged Jews in a vociferous way the evilness of the Jewish people. And so the irony of this is that the people read this thing around the world and believed what it said. Remember the irony of this was that God used that bad document for their good because now the whole world thinks the Jews have power. And our author, my author here, no, the author of my paper, not this guy, makes a point of it, and we'll see it next week, makes a point of how is it that the Jews that have no power run everything? Because it's the imagined power they have. They don't have power. They don't even vote, except maybe in their, maybe they don't even vote wherever, depending on where they are. But they don't have any power. Yet the world walks around them as if they are an atom bomb. If you step on it, it'll go off. And all this has been made up by the Gentiles about the Jews. Isn't that, to me, that's one of those ironic things about what God does. They meant it for evil. God took it for the good. And so this power that the Jews supposedly had, and our author again said, I don't know where they ever get the idea. It's one of the ironies of history. That people think that the Jews have this power when they have none. And I know, but not in a political sense. We're talking about political sense. But you went right, you went to where you go. Well, see, now that's God working. But the man in the pew doesn't see it. The guy that reads the paper doesn't think that way. He's saying, we got to satisfy the Jews because if we don't, the Jews are going to, I don't know, but they're going to do it. And we better get on with it. And so we have the Catholic Church arguing with each other, and the Jews win. Germany argues with Russia, Jews win. It's amazing. And it's just absolutely amazing.